This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Most of us probably don't give too much thought to the act of parking, other than the momentary triumph of grabbing a spot that might be convenient and relatively inexpensive. Donald Shoup believes the parking space is worth much more than a passing thought. In fact, Shoup says we're poisoning our cities with too much parking, that it can impose a burden on the poor, contribute to climate change, even degrade urban design. We're going to spend the next hour examining why many city planners feel the need to accommodate so many cars, what change might look like, and how it would affect those of us who commute by car. Donald Shoup is Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning in the Luskin School of Urban Affairs at UCLA and author of The High Cost of Free Parking. Welcome to Radio Times, Donald.
Thanks for inviting me.
So let's begin with a bit of history. You say that for much of the past century, our cities have been built to suit the car. How so?
Well, for about the past 60 years, since World War II, almost all cities have minimum parking requirements, saying that nothing can be built unless it has ample parking. Usually that means ample free parking. So most of us have become accustomed to parking free at grocery stores and Walmarts and places like that. Everybody wants to park free, including me. But if the driver doesn't pay for parking, somebody else has to pay for parking. That somebody is everybody, including people who are too poor to own a car. So I think that that some cities are beginning to realize that the older parts of town are much pleasanter than suburban malls.
The older parts meaning not as much parking.
That's right. They were built either before the car, like Philadelphia, or in the early years of the car without minimum parking requirements. And that means that the buildings come right up to the sidewalk, and you don't have to walk past parking lots or parking garages. So I think that people are beginning to realize that cities that are parking light, or the parts of cities that are parking light, are really the kind of place we like to be.
A single parking space can cost more to build than the net worth of any number of American households?
Yes. In Philadelphia, the average cost of a parking space in an above-ground structure is about $24,000, and underground it's $34,000. In most cities, there are three or four parking spaces for every car. How does that cost compare with our ability to pay for it? We think we're a rich nation, and we are in many ways. But the median net wealth, that is the all your assets minus your liabilities, is about $80,000 a household in the U.S. But for Latino families, it's about $7,000, and for black families, it's about $6,000. That is, half of all black families have a net wealth less than $6,000, and 34% of them have negative net wealth, meaning that they owe more than they have assets. So cities are requiring a lot of parking spaces, each of which costs more than three times the median net wealth of many people.
So earlier you drew a line between the cost of building parking and poverty. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that we've created in new parts of the city an environment where it's very hard to live without a car. If you could park free wherever you go, to a grocery store or to a restaurant or a movie theater, somebody has to pay for that parking. It is clearly everybody. And that cost is being shifted to people who really can't afford it in an invisible way. Parking requirement shifts the cost of parking away from drivers, or away from people in their role as drivers, to every other role they have, as a customer, as a somebody who's eating at a restaurant or shopping at a store, or as a taxpayer. The burden is shifted everywhere in society, including people who just have a terrible time affording it. And I think further, if you have an environment where it's hard to get around without a car. Even poor people feel that the car is necessary, and they have to borrow to buy it, which adds they have to support their cars to get around in our city. And the sometimes they even have to finance it with a subprime interest rate. We've heard of title loans for cars where people are paying very high interest rates to buy a car that they need.
So parking, the cost of building parking translates into higher costs for buildings, groceries, apartments.
Housing, definitely.
Housing. So the person who, if there's a new apartment building going up, and somebody moves in, two families move in, one family has a car, one family does not. Does the family without the car then subsidize the family with the car? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, definitely. And the family with the car subsidizes the car through higher prices for housing. The cost of parking is bundled into the price of housing. So we pay for our parking, but we're paying for it through higher rents. But if we have two spaces available for us, the only way we can take advantage of that is to have a car. So if you have a car, a parking space at home, and parking space at work, and every place else you go, it's almost irresistible to want a car.
How do you change the structure that has been built? So many of us, myself included, commute into the city with cars, and it might be difficult to do otherwise. And so you need parking.
Well, one policy I like is called parking cash out. It's a law in California that if you're certainly free parking for commuters is a generous offer, and who could object to that? But if you offer free parking to drivers and nothing to anybody else, you're really subsidizing the car. So in California, for firms that rent their parking spaces to offer to employees, which is what happens in downtown, say here at WHYY, you don't own parking spaces, but if you offer free parking to your employees and nothing to everybody else, it's unfair. But in California, you're required to offer the employees the option to choose the cash value of the parking if you don't take the parking. Sounds very generous to people who walk or bike or take the bus, but it just treats everybody equally.
Yeah. Well, that's a terrific concept. But I guess where I was going with that question was city planners, when they are talking about minimum parking requirements and zoning for minimum parking requirements, do they have in mind this vast number of commuters who come into the city with cars? Is that what they're thinking of? And is that why it's so hard for them to change course?
When you think of a place like Philadelphia, there aren't high parking requirements in the center city because they're not assuming that everybody is going to come by car. The high parking requirements are usually focused in the more suburban areas. Or, say, the place like Houston or Los Angeles, you have minimum parking requirements, even downtown. I think that the parking requirements themselves add a lot of cost and do a lot of harm. Isn't that an odd combination? They add a lot of cost and do a lot of harm. And you can compare cities like San Francisco and downtown. I mean, if you had a choice of going to a convention in downtown San Francisco or downtown L.A., which would you prefer? Well, San Francisco is very exciting. They have limits on parking, not minimums. And L.A. has minimums with no maximums. So somebody's got to be wrong, I think. Should you have minimums with no maximums or maximums without minimums? So say if you're going to a concert downtown, you probably heard of Disney Hall or our iconic concert hall. San Francisco has a similar one, Louise Davies Hall. Well, in L.A., L.A. requires 50 times more parking as the minimum than San Francisco allows as the maximum.
Okay. So, Donald Shoup, you also say there's a connection between new parking and degradation of urban design. How so?
Well, I think you just have to open your eyes and see that there are a lot of places in low-density areas where there's an awful lot of asphalt. Nothing can be built without a lot of asphalt. And I think some cities are beginning to realize that why not let the developer decide how much parking there should be? The developer knows how much the parking spaces cost, and the architect knows how the parking affects the urban design. So some cities are beginning to just deregulate it and say, if you want to say in some of these suburban malls, they say, if you want to convert some of that parking into housing, you can. Just let it happen. And I think that you could provide housing in job-adjacent areas where people can walk to work if you allow the property owner to say, well, this parking isn't yielding any revenue. It doesn't look good. Say, new urbanists talk about a liner building. Say, they put around the perimeter of a giant parking lot, they'll put a thin layer of housing or commercial development. So as you walk along the street, it'll look more like downtown Philadelphia. But right behind it, there's a parking lot. But the city has to allow it.
All right. Before we get to the break, let's get an email in from Matt, who asks, how much per month does the free parking in a city cost an average citizen in dollars? Do you have those numbers?
That's hard to say. If you have a car in that free parking, it seems very good. You don't know really who's paying for it. I think that there was one estimate of what is the total parking subsidy in the United States for off-street parking. So the difference between the cost of providing the parking and what drivers pay for it. And this estimate was somewhere between what we pay for Medicare and national defense.
How would you change?
Excuse me, that's about between 1 and 4% of our national income goes to subsidize off-street parking. That wasn't my calculation, but a professor at the University of California at Davis.
Okay. So what is the vision that you want city planners to hold and commuters to hold as a city, say, like Philadelphia, moves forward in determining new construction and possible parking?
Well, I have three legs to the stool that I'm recommending, three things that should go together. One is to charge the right price for on-street parking. Who could object to the right price? What do I mean by the right price? I mean the price that will leave one or two open spaces on every block. This is for on-street parking. So that everybody will have great parking karma. Wherever you go, you'll see an open space waiting for you. If there are a lot of open spaces, the price is too high. If there are no open spaces, the price is too low. If there are one or two open spaces, the price is just right.
And we've got a break coming up, but quickly, the right price, is that generally involved raising the prices a little bit?
Well, San Francisco was the first place to try this Goldilocks principle of parking prices. Everybody thought, including me, that the price would go down, but on average, prices declined a little bit by 4% because so much parking was overpriced in the morning.
All right, Donald Shoup is our guest. He is the author of The High Cost of Free Parking. We've got calls coming in already. Surprise, 888-477-9499. There's more of Radio Times just ahead. You're listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscawain. Our guest this hour says a surfeit of parking in this country is contributing to urban poverty, climate change, and even damaging the economy. But many city planners feel they need to make room for more parking. Donald Shoup is author of The High Cost of Free Parking and a distinguished professor of urban planning in the Luskin School of Urban Affairs at UCLA. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes at whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Donald, before we went into the break, we were talking about three elements you believe will change the vision looking down the road for cities regarding parking. You talked about the right price for spaces. Quickly, what are the other two?
Well, to make these right prices politically popular, I recommend that the city should spend the meter revenue to pay for added public services on the metered blocks so that people will see the meter money at work.
So keep it local.
That's right. So that and be very flamboyant about what you're doing. Say that, say in Pasadena, where they try this. The meters say turning small change into big changes, sidewalks, street furniture, street trees. They steam clean the sidewalk with the money twice a month. They sweep the sidewalks every night. They remove graffiti every night.
This is in Pasadena.
That's right. The money is so obvious that the environment is a lot better because of the meter money. They actually rebuilt all the sidewalks with the meter money. So there are no black chewing gum polka dots on the sidewalk that you get used to in the city.
So before we get to point three, where does the meter money go in general, say in a large city like Philadelphia?
It disappears into the general fund. Hmm. Nobody can. You might as well send the money to Mars for any political clout. But if the merchants and the property owners and the residents all see the meter money at work, and they know that a lot of that meter money is paid for by visitors, not by it isn't tax taxes on the businesses or the housing. It's paid for by people who are using the meters, and when they get out of their cars, they're getting into a much better environment. But if you dedicate that money to pay for services on the block where it's paid, it becomes very popular. In mm-hmm. Pasadena, when they started doing, the merchants had bitterly opposed parking meters. And as soon as the city said, we'll spend it here, they said, let's run the meters till midnight. Let's run them on Sunday.
So, and point three.
And then you could remove the minimum parking requirements, because if you have the right price for parking, there will always be one or two open spaces on every block. And nobody can say there's a shortage of parking. And then you don't need off-street parking requirements. You don't need anybody to tell you what to do when you're building an apartment building.
Let's get to the phones. Dave in Drescher, you're live on Radio Times. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Mary. Nice to speak with you.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask your guest if he thought that maybe automated cars will take care of this problem in their own right. You know, maybe my car can drop me off at work, drop my kids off at school, and then go park itself somewhere centralized with every other car in the township.
A look into the future. Thanks, Dave.
Well, I don't think that will happen in my lifetime, maybe in yours, but I think that if we do begin charging the right prices for parking, that these automated cars will happen earlier. If you could park your conventional car free wherever you go, there's not that much incentive to buy an automated car. But if you could avoid expensive parking with an automated car, then I think there'll be a market for them.
Okay, so the connection between a surfeit of parking spaces and pollution. Let's talk about how the simple act of looking for a parking space can affect our carbon footprint.
Yes, well, if the on-street parking is too cheap, meaning that all the spaces are full, we have to drive around hunting for a space. So the first studies of cruising for parking date back to 1927 in Detroit, appropriately, and they found that about 20% of the cars on the street were hunting for parking. And other cities have done this on four continents over 80 years, and they found that on average, they only look in places where they expect to find cruising, about 30% of the cars on the street are circling the block. They're not going anywhere. They've already arrived, and they don't want to be driving. They're hunting for underpriced, in my view, parking.
Well, you did a study in which you and your students found, you studied a 15-block business district in L.A., and the average cruising time was how long? When you're looking for a spot.
A little over 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So, and when you multiply that out, that's a lot of people who are traveling every day, looking 3 minutes, cruising, looking for a space, and that obviously contributes greatly to the problem.
Well, that's right. We studied it for a year. And sometimes when there were open spaces early in the morning, there was nobody cruising. But as the day went on and all the spaces were filled up, the time to find a space went up. That if more people want to park and all the spaces are full, the only thing that can happen is more people are cruising. So when you add up all the people who parked in the village and multiply that by the distance they cruised, about a half a mile, for it took 3 minutes, not that much. But it turned out to be almost a million vehicle miles a year in a 15-block area. That's four trips to the moon or 36 trips around the earth hunting for free parking or underpriced parking in a little business center. I'm sure it's happening in similar parts of Philadelphia. And that's why planners want off-street parking requirements, because if there's so much off-street parking, nobody's going to cruise.
Do most cities have what they need in terms of know-how, technology, to do the work of figuring out plans that fold in questions like location, time of day, into an ideal, what is it, 85% occupancy rate for parking?
Yes, I recommend one or two spaces on every block. And that's about 85% occupancy and 15% vacancy. And the technology is now there to do this. We have occupancy sensors in the street that San Francisco use, and L.A. uses the same thing.
Well, what does an occupancy sensor
do? Well, is the space occupied or empty? So you can say whether are there one or two vacant spaces on the street. Let's say in L.A., the data are sent to a Xerox facility in Toulouse, France, and they analyze it, and they look at all the year's occupancy and what it was the last month on every block, and they send back a recommendation to L.A. to say, well, what should be the price next month? And they adjust the price. The meters don't have to be touched. They charge different prices at different times of day, but they all aim for one or two open spaces. And the prices vary dramatically from one block to another. It's more than I could ever imagine, even from one side of the street to another.
Why is that?
Sometimes the dominant flow is in one direction rather than the other direction. There are more people want to park on one side of the street than on the other.
There really is a science to this, isn't there?
There is, but cities don't have to do it for themselves. You don't have city staff doing it. They hire contractors, in LA's case, Xerox, who recommend the meters and the pricing and It's worked out better than I imagined, but what did surprise me is the great variation in prices. Say in San Francisco, 17% of all the spaces went down to 25 cents an hour. They'd started out at $2, 25 cents an hour, and only a few spaces went up to $6 an hour. But from one block to the next, it can vary by more than a dollar an hour.
Okay, let's get to the phones once again. Phil in Abington, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
To relate to the increasing the public, the cost of the public parking, and the relationship between privates. Does it increase the number of private lots?
We're having some difficulty hearing you, Phil, but what I'm seeing on the screen, Phil's question is, what is the relationship between increasing costs of public parking and the appearance of private lots competing with that?
Well, this demand-based pricing doesn't mean always increasing. It often means decreasing. Say in San Francisco and L.A., more prices went down than up. But I don't think it has had much effect on the off-street parking, except that it makes it hard to charge these very high prices for the first hour of off-street parking. You know, often when you go to a garage, it will be $12 for the first hour and then $2 an hour after that. People who just want to park for an hour and are in a hurry, they will pay for that. But if you could always get a space on the street, say, for $3 an hour, nobody can charge $12 for the first hour off-street. So I think the big effect on off-street parking, off-street priced parking, most off-street parking is free, except in downtown. But when you go in suburban areas, the off-street parking is all free, as well as the on-street is. But I think that most in downtown Philadelphia, for example, most parking is off-street, and I don't think getting the prices right on-street will do anything other than reduce the price of the first hour off-street.
And we've got an email from another person named Phil, who says, I've always said it's easier to park in New York City than Philly, and no one believes me. Is this true? Is there any rank list of the best, worst major cities for parking? And thank you. Anything you know of, Donald Chu?
I think that, well, I won't argue with anybody who has personal experience, but in New York, there are a lot of off-street garages with very high prices, so you could almost always find an off-street space. In fact, many off-street operators say they don't have a full side. They say, well, why would I need one? Because they always adjust prices to make sure. If they're full, their prices go up. But on street, I think, at least in Manhattan, it's very difficult to find on-street parking that's free.
We've got calls and comments coming in to 888-477-9499. Our email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us, of course, at WHYY Radio Times. Let's get to an email from Sharon, who says, I sit through a lot of zoning hearings. In my experience, residential developers are more likely to be seeking approvals for on-site parking than to be asking for exemptions from minimum parking requirements. And parking is the issue most likely to bring out objectors, longtime residents concerned about losing scarce, I'm assuming she's going to say losing scarce space on street spaces.
Yes, I think if developers want to provide more than the minimum, there's no point in having a minimum. That's one thing I would say, that if you think developers want to put in parking on by themselves, there's no reason for the city to force it. But I certainly understand the idea that people who now park on the street don't want any competition from sure. other people. They're here and they don't want anybody else. And if anybody else comes, they have to come with a lot of parking so there won't be any competition.
Well, let's talk about the concept of creating parking permit districts.
Yes.
Which would protect neighborhoods.
Yes.
Then who you know, people want to park there. This would charge non-residents for parking. So get into that for us, if you would.
Well, in areas where anyone objects to new developments that that will, without parking or with little parking, that will create an increase in demand for on-street parking, the cities can put in permit parking districts. And in some cities, that if a developer wants to provide no parking in the building, the residents of the building can't get on-street parking permits. So you can't say that the residents of this building are going to cause an on-street parking problem because they won't have on-street parking permits. And if there are people who want to live without a car or are willing to live without a car, I don't see why we should prohibit the construction of housing for them. I think we would probably be happier if people arrived without a car. In most neighborhoods, a new residents without a car wouldn't even be noticed. It's only if they have a car that they create problems. In some cities, they also have overnight parking districts so that nobody can come into the area and park overnight without mm-hmm. a permit, so that you can't. You can't own a car and expect to park it on the street unless you have an overnight parking permit. Sure. The city's charged for those. So I think that there are lots of ways we could solve the on-street parking problem without requiring a lot of off-street parking for every new building.
We've got a Facebook comment from TY who says, simply improve mass transit.
Well, I think that allowing more housing and commerce without parking will increase the demand for mass transit. In places like L.A., we have a lot of mass transit, but we don't have a lot of mass transit riders. We need more riders, paying riders, than we need more subways in L.A. I think if I were a transit manager, I would like to see more housing without parking requirements. I'm not against cars. I'm not against parking. What I am against is parking subsidies. There's no reason to subsidize parking in this nation, especially we can no longer afford it. We think we're a rich nation, but we have to get used to the fact that we're not, that there are a lot of people in this country who are just barely making it paycheck to paycheck. There was a recent Federal Reserve survey of people saying if you had an emergency $400 expense, say like a medical expense or automobile mm-hmm. expense, how would you pay it? And 47% of the population said they would have difficulty paying it.
And you say that a good chunk of that population is actually subsidizing parking for people who are rich enough to have cars.
That's right. They're parking it for themselves and for even if they don't have a car. We have parking requirements at grocery stores so that richer people can park free when they get there, even if some people arrive without a car.
Let's get to an email from Paolo, who says drivers should not pay the full cost of parking because they are not the only beneficiary. Retailers should pay a portion. They make money from the patron. They can't necessarily pass the cost on, though. I don't know if it would work that way if they were chipping in for the cost of parking.
Well, now they're required to chip in for the full cost of parking at shopping malls and places like that. But I think that if the retailer benefits from parking, they can subsidize it themselves. They don't have to have the public subsidize it. And some of them validate parking. If a merchant thinks they benefit from parking, they can validate it.
Ultimately, you say minimum parking requirements damage the economy. Again, could you get into that a little more fully for us?
Well, it's very difficult to build new buildings when you have to dig an 8-story hole in the ground beforehand in order to get the required parking. In many cases, cities seem to require you to build parking, and then they allow you to build a building to finance it. That there's so many things that don't happen because of parking requirements. And we found this out in Los Angeles, which has great buildings downtown, you know, not quite as many as Philadelphia, but L.A. is said to have the largest intact collection of office buildings from the early 20th century than any other city on Earth. They were wonderful Art Deco and Beaux-Arts buildings built up until the Depression. And then they fell on hard times. They were wonderful buildings in terrible condition. The demand for office space moved to an urban renewal area on Bunker Hill. So the buildings were too expensive to tear down. They either became clothing warehouses or something, but they couldn't be converted into housing because they didn't meet the minimum parking requirement.
All right, I've got to stop you there as we go to a break. Donald Shoup, Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning at the Luskin School of Urban Affairs at UCLA. More of Radio Time straight ahead. Stay with us. You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain, and our guest is Donald Shoup, author of The High Cost of Free Parking and a distinguished professor of urban planning in the Luskin School of Urban Affairs at UCLA. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Or a tweet at WHYY Radio Time. So Donald Shoup, is there anything positive about minimum parking requirements?
Well, let me talk more about the positive effects of not having them.
Okay.
That I mentioned there were these wonderful buildings in downtown L.A.
Yeah.
In terrible condition, but they couldn't be converted into housing, for which there was a big demand. There's a shortage of housing almost everywhere because the buildings didn't meet the parking requirements for housing. They didn't have 2 parking spaces per what would be a new apartment. And finally, the city passed what's called the Adaptive Reuse Ordinance, saying you could convert these older office buildings into new housing without any new parking. And some people said it'll be a disaster, it won't happen, nobody will lend for that, nobody will want to buy it. It turns out in the 8 years after they did that, 57 historic office buildings were converted into housing. And just think of all the people who got work as architects and designers and glaziers and plumbers and electricians and everything else. You say, how does this affect the economy? I think it showed at all the something like 7,000 new apartments that were developed. And this just shows what the parking requirements had been preventing.
I was just going to ask, are urban planners elsewhere paying attention?
Some cities have switched from minimum parking requirements to maximum parking limits, and most of the downtowns that you want to go to, like San Francisco or Chicago or Boston or New York and maybe Philadelphia, they don't have minimum parking requirements. When you walk around downtown Philadelphia, it could not have happened with minimum parking requirements. And new buildings couldn't be built if they had to meet suburban-style parking requirements. So you often can't see what doesn't happen. But the ARO ordinance in L.A., with all these buildings that blossomed into beautiful restorations, and it didn't save just individual buildings, but an entire historic district, the parking requirements had been preventing them and damaging the economy.
All right, back to the phones we go. Dave is calling from the vicinity of the Ben Franklin Bridge. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually not on the bridge anymore.
Okay.
Situated in Camden. But my question for your guest, and I can probably guess the answer, but I'm wondering what he feels about the policy, I believe it's the case in Philadelphia, where new townhomes have to have a garage so that the first floor in the front is going to be a garage door instead of a door, like a front door and windows, like the traditional. And also, it seems to me like you maybe gain the spot of off-street parking, but you lose a spot of on-street parking because of the curb cut. So I'll take my answer off. Yeah.
Thanks, Dave. What do you think?
Well, I think you've got it exactly right, that the townhomes look unlike older townhomes that you admire in Philadelphia, and it takes away space inside the building, and you lose the parking space on the street in front. So I think if the city managed the on-street parking and dedicated each on-street space to the building that it faces, you would have a much better looking building that they could look like the buildings we admire from the 18th century.
Let's get to an email from Andrew, who says you are definitely a visionary. And he says, I think that Philadelphia would do well to adopt some of his ideas. However, I do feel, Andrew says, that getting rid of the minimum parking requirement is a difficult political goal, unfortunately. Does he, not all Shoup, do you have a good solution for getting elected officials to fight for this change in the face of constituents that go to zoning board meetings and complain that there needs to be insane amounts of parking for each new development?
Well, the solution that I would recommend would be to manage the on-street parking properly so that in commercial areas it would yield a lot of revenue to pay for things that people really want, and in residential areas to have permit parking so that nobody can complain that new development is going to create a mess in front of their house because they have to have an on-street permit to park there. So I think if you protect the residents, you have to, there are a lot of vested interests, and you can't ignore them. But I think you can mollify them, and I think the way to mollify them is to protect them. And I don't see how you could demand on-street or off-street parking requirements for a new apartment building if the people in the apartment buildings can't get a permit to park on the street.
You seem to take, in your writings, you seem to take many urban planners to the woodshed, comparing them to the wizard in the Wizard of Oz.
Uh-huh.
How so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my book came out in 2005 and the second edition in 2011, but in the book, I said that minimum parking requirements damage the economy, they harm the environment, they exclude the poor, they pollute the air, they congest traffic, they do a lot of things. And to my knowledge, not a single urban planner has ever said minimum parking requirements do not have these effects. So it's as though that somehow I'm afraid I am now a senior member of the profession. And here it's published by the American Planning Association, and still not much has changed. Some things have changed. I'm on this radio show, for one thing.
Happy to have you here.
but change is always going to be slow, and I think that planners have been more emboldened by my book, that there's that they're willing to, young planners especially, are willing to speak out now and saying that the minimum parking requirements are doing a lot of damage. I mean, would you like to go to a doctor who prescribes medicine the way planners set parking requirements? You know, for hundreds of parking requirements for hundreds of land uses and no evidence for any of them.
Yes, and Donald Shoup, you also compare the requirement for off-street parking to the old and mistaken medical practice of prescribing lead for any variety of ailments. Just wanted to bring that up briefly.
Well, that's right. And getting back to Ben Franklin, he warned against the danger of lead. In the 18th century, he'd been a printer, and he knew that they used lead for printing, and he knew that it did a lot of damage. And I think he said, you know, we've known of this damage from lead for over 60 years, but it takes a long time for people to act on it. And just like we had lead in gasoline until the 1970s,
that's right.
Now we have lead in drinking water. So if you take the long view that we could make mistakes for a long time, but I think the world is different now. That we have radio programs like this, we have email, we have blogs, and you know, people who are malcontents like me can chastise the profession. I think
more quickly and easily. Yes.
Yeah, I think the planning profession itself has to stop recommending minimum parking requirements.
All right. Barbara has sent an email. She says, I've lived in Seattle 23 years. For the last 6 years, I worked in downtown Seattle. My large employer eventually gave all of us free annual passes for public transportation. My pass was one of my prized possessions. Parking was so difficult to find and prohibitively expensive, and the public transportation was so good that I was happy to ride the bus. How can more cities promote this type of subsidy for their employees, and how can urban policies reward employers who do this? That's important.
Well, cities could have the parking cash-out requirement that if you're offered a parking, if you as an employer offer a parking subsidy, you have to offer the option to take a transit pass or the cash value. But I would say, getting back to the program you had the previous hour about universities, that many universities have a very enlightened policy is that your student ID serves as a transit pass, that the university makes a contract with the transit operator so that they accept the university ID as a transit pass. So every student can ride free anywhere. And if you're going to put up with living in Philadelphia or L.A. as a young person, if you have a transit pass, you could take advantage of the city. Say UCLA, before we started doing it, there are students who never left Westwood during the year, when they could go to the beach, they could go to the mountains, they could go to the Getty Center, they could go downtown. But as soon as you figure out how to make this contract between universities and transit agencies, young people will grow up knowing where the buses go.
Not everybody is buying into what you have to say, Donald. We have a website comment from ComCom who says, the guest sounds like a lobbyist for real estate developers. He's trying to convince people it is in their interest to reduce regulations for real estate developers so they no longer have to give up billable real estate to provide parking for the people. To suggest that real estate prices would go down, he says, is laughable, he or she, to present this as a benefit to the people. So what's your response?
Well, as I say, everybody wants to park free, and you'll think of any reason you can and to defend it and blame developers. But I don't see why we should force developers to provide parking even for people who don't own a car. I think to some extent, when we think about parking, most people's mental level shifts to a lower grade. That they say things about parking that they wouldn't say about something they really understand. That people think about parking using their reptilian cortex of the brain, which developed first to make snap decisions like how to avoid being eaten, but it's not really reflective thinking this through. And I think if developers wanted to provide more housing and less parking, then parking would get more expensive and housing would get less expensive. The only way to really decrease the price of housing is to have more of it. You've heard of demand and supply. If the supply goes up, the price will go down.
Yeah.
And we have driven up the price of housing by limiting the amount of housing we can build.
Donald Shoup, you say coming to grips with the parking problem in America is essential because, according to your book, the rest of the world is poised to repeat our mistakes.
Oh, well, they are repeating our mistakes, definitely. But on the other hand, they're benefiting to some extent from the solutions that are developing here. Say, I do. I have a second life now, traveling around the world, making presentations. And
you have a Facebook following for your book called The Shoupistas?
That's right. They don't follow me, but they follow the policies that I recommend. And you think in China, where they have much higher population density, and they're going all out to buy cars, they have terrible parking problems. And when I spoke,
and a lot of pollution in places.
Terrible pollution.
Not just from the parking. But
and congestion. Yeah. I mean, it's just awful. I mean, our problems are nothing compared to theirs. But when I said the idea, well, let's charge the right price for parking and spend the revenue to improve your decayed area. Some of the urban areas don't even have indoor plumbing. You have to walk outside to a public toilet. So here's my elevator talk for China. If you charge for the on-street parking and spent the revenue to make first-class public toilets, everybody thought that was a great idea. It isn't just cleaning the chewing gum off the sidewalks. It's making your toilets usable. So I think that some of the rest of the world is ready to pick up these ideas.
Okay, a website comment from Dee. So how would other vehicles, trucks, motorcycles, and bicycles fit into this scheme since they have different parking needs? Good question.
Well, the bicycles have far lower parking needs, and if you arrive by bus, you don't need any parking at all. So I think that bicyclists and transit riders would be the big beneficiaries of this policy, because it wouldn't be so unthinkable to use a curb lane for a bike lane if you could easily get parking around the corner for if you're driving a car. So truck parking is very important. I think that that we have truck loading zones and but that doesn't mean that trucks should park free. They take up much more parking space than an automobile. So I think that if we charge trucks the right price, the drivers wouldn't be sitting in a restaurant, having lunch while the truck is parked on Market Street.
We have time for one more comment. Got about a minute left in the program. Email from Edward. It seems to me, Edward says, that offering parking spaces by competitive bidding is an application of the theory of rent as developed by Henry George and traced back to David Ricardo. Are you similarly in favor of moving to a land-only property tax base as a means of allocating land to its highest, best use?
Yes, I'm a Henry Georgist, but I think that charging for parking is a step in that direction. It isn't putting taxes on private land, it's charging for land the government already owns. I think it's a mistake to think that we should just have free on-street parking, but urge site value taxation off-street. I think that charging for on-street parking is a step in the direction that the state of Pennsylvania is ahead of most states in thinking of charging a higher tax on land. But this is land the government owns, I'm talking about.
Let's just close the show. I like this quote. Considering the prospect of changing the parking culture, you quote Supreme Court Justice Benjamin Cardozo, "Justice is not to be taken by storm. She is to be wooed by slow advances."
Well, thanks for allowing me to make a slow advance in Philadelphia.
Thank you so much, Donald Shoup. A fun conversation. Donald is a distinguished professor of urban planning in the Luskin School of Urban Affairs at UCLA and author of The High Cost of Free Parking. As always, don't forget to check out our Facebook page. For a behind-the-scenes look at Radio Times, head to whyy.org/radiotimes, where you will find our podcasts as well. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Our intern today is Abby Sarfo. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, sitting in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times.